Whether seaside piers or at inland support facilities, the Navy is working to ensure energy independence so it can keep going if the power goes out. It's also working to increase facility resilience to extreme weather and rising tides. For more, at the Sea Air Space Conference, I spoke with the Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy, Installations, and Environment, James Balaki.
Really what we're looking at is what we're trying to achieve for energy security and resilience aboard those bases. And it's focused around the mission, whether it's launching ships or launching aircraft and recovering them for our mission. It's about ensuring that energy is available in plentiful supply, abundant quantities, regardless of the type that we're using.
All right, because we have heard some of the services have been experimenting with local grids and alternative sources of energy for those local grids, so they're not tied to the, say, the commercial grid that might be in the area. What's going on in the Navy?
The Navy is certainly taking a very aggressive look at what's called microgrids, the idea that if the grid goes down or for some reason you need to isolate from it, you can, in fact, throw the switch, as it were, and basically operate the installation as an island separate. We've got a couple of really great examples. One I'd love to tell you about is Marine Corps Air Station Yuma. And we've, for several years, had a microgrid out there. And fascinatingly enough, whenever power gets above or below the voltage you expected, so you plug in and expect to get 120 and all of a sudden it's 100 volts, well, for sensitive equipment like F-35 simulators, that causes problems. And so our ability to island or bring ourselves off the commercial grid allows us to continue to operate those simulators without losing time because they shut down or trip because of the challenges with power that's not correctly conditioned.
Got it. Because the Navy and the Marine Corps are all over the country, not just on the coastal areas. But looking at the coastal areas, your strategy then involves independence because of resiliency to weather or just general security because anything could happen to the grid.
So the idea of resilience is more expansive than just climate or weather. It takes into account things that climate causes, so fires, droughts. We would even say that COVID has created a resilience issue, right? The pandemic. But beyond that, cyber threats represent a threat to resilience of our installations. Climate, as we mentioned, and certainly energy is a big one.
So how do you tie in with the cybersecurity people in doing some of these experiments like you mentioned in Yuma?
Right. So cyber is integrated into our design and construction practices. And then we also monitor our cyber networks separately from our information networks. In fact, the building control systems that operate a place like this represent as much or more threat to the ability to operate it as our information networks do that you sit down at your keyboard every day. So we have to protect and defend that in exactly the same way.
And given the temperatures in here today, I could say they're trying to conserve fuel or energy in any way they can.
Possibly.
But we talked about the grid, which, of course, is the physical basis of that security and resiliency. What about the sources of what goes on to the wire? What's happening there?
So really, the power plants, largely we depend, by and large, on the commercial sector, the private sector, to generate and transmit power. Where we'll get into a smaller, isolated situation, we'll put into place a cogeneration plant, for example, or solar or wind production with the ability with batteries then to time shift, right? Because sun doesn't shine at night. You've got to have the ability to draw power at night. So we're employing all of those techniques to be able to ensure that we're resilient and able to operate 24/7 as America depends on us whenever the call should come out.
So your strategy then is not to be completely independent of all commercial sources, but just to have your own kind of backup resiliency because commercial failures happen in winter or whatever.
Right, precisely. Precisely. I would say we are an integral part of the communities where we're partners with not only the power sources, but, the roadway networks, the utilities generally, they become an important part of who we are and how we operate. And so we have to reach out beyond the gates when we look at resilience. We can't just look at the resilience of the gate. If the first node outside the gate fails, that represents a failure to us as well.
What about overseas installations, say Guam, where there's really major presence of the U.S. Navy? Are you looking at those areas for this type of work?
We are. Guam certainly represents, as a territory of the United States, represents a certain affinity, and we're looking particularly at solar there, as one might imagine, as an ability to provide some backup and time-shifted power. And certainly the resilience of all of the capabilities that we've got on Guam as a very far forward naval base, much like Hawaii, but even further forward, right, has to be protected and maintain a resilience.
And then, we're in Japan and in a lot of other places, other countries, too.
Exactly. And then we begin to rely on host governments to be a partner as well.
And getting to the larger question of modernization, installation work, there's a big backlog. There's also the need, as you say, to modernize some of the installations. What are your plans for 22, 23? What are you looking at?
So our priorities generally are focused around a couple of things. I think first and foremost, and you've heard this in the news, the shipyards certainly need to be modernized. Our ability to generate power by maintaining those aircraft carriers and subs and get them in and out when the combatant commanders need them is critically important. Certainly our strategic weapons facilities, places.
And just to get back to the shipbuilding for a moment, there's a real capacity issue there, too.
So I don't deal necessarily in the capacity, but we have to maintain, you know, what the capacity we have and certainly an operational and a way that the velocity of ship movement through the maintenance cycles
right.
is not impeded by the facilities, the infrastructure.
So if they increase the capacity, then you've got a bigger job because you've got more to worry about.
Precisely.
If someone else does that.
Precisely.
Okay. And you were talking about the nuclear.
Just so the strategic weapons facilities, and then we'll be looking to our unaccompanied housing as another priority as well.
Yeah, housing's been an issue for, I guess, all the armed services,
right.
and you got to get around that one. And what about commercial partners like shipbuilding yards? Does the resiliency and the ability to keep operating the Navy's priorities extend to them, or do you just say, Lytton, just make sure you can operate no matter what?
So while we would certainly have some concerns about that and we'll encourage them to do the right thing for their own business, they run their business, and frankly, we're going to leave that to them.
All right. Anything else you want to tell
us? Well, we're just delighted that the Navy League has included the installations and energy community here in Sea Air Space this year. This is the first time that I'm aware of that the EINE, that's the installations community, has been a party to this. And we're looking forward to the panel later this afternoon and, frankly, look forward to learning and meeting a bunch of leaders that are important to our Navy and Marine Corps. The integration of the seafaring forces as well as the Coast Guard is critical to our nation's security, and we appreciate being included in that.
Okay.
Let me make one more example
sure,
as well.
Okay.
So another great example of resilience for sea level rise is the new piers that we're constructing. For example, in Point Loma out in San Diego, we've constructed a two-level pier that can adapt to sea level rise it's projected over the next 100 years to be able to adapt to whatever those sea levels might be. So it's a fascinating design adaptation to a challenging problem that Mother Nature's thrown at us.
Just need longer anchor chains.
Presumably, yes. Again, not my portfolio.
But you'll let them know.
I will let them know, yeah.
All right,
a few
good.
More links.
James Bilocki is Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy, Installations, and Environment. We spoke at the Sea Air Space Conference hosted by the Navy League. We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Catch the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I am your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Vice Admiral Cutler Dawson. Cutler has had an incredible career serving our country for 35 years in the Navy, where he attained the rank of Vice Admiral. And during his service, he had numerous assignments afloat and ashore, including Commander, Second Fleet, Striking Fleet Atlantic, and in Washington at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, where he was the Navy's Chief of Legislative Affairs. Immediately following his retirement from active duty in 2004, he became the president and CEO of Navy Federal Credit Union, the world's largest credit union, where he served for 14 years. Under his leadership, Navy Federal grew from 2 million to 8 million members. Phenomenal. Cutler, welcome and thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Shane.
You've had a fascinating career across both military and the private sector. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and your professional journey?
Well, I started out at the Naval Academy, where I graduated in 1970, and then, as you mentioned, spent 35 years in the Navy with six actual afloat commands. The first one was when I was 27 years old. I didn't know enough to be scared of anything, and it was probably one of the highlights of my career. And then after I retired after 35 years, I went to work at Navy Federal Credit Union as the CEO, where I spent my next 14 years. I'm currently retired and enjoying life, and it's been a great run for me.
How would you describe your leadership style, and how's that developed over the years?
My style has been quite consistent. I believe, and I've learned this in the Navy, that you have to go to the deck plates to see what is going on. And you have to learn what your people do and how they do it so you can help them to be better at it and more efficient and more productive. It's something that you need to do all the time. I remember I used to tell folks that you don't want to retreat to your cabin. And what I mean by that is the longer you're in a position, the less you think you have to get out and about. But that should be the opposite. You should get out and about more because people change, situations change, and you've got to figure out a way to get to them and find out what they're doing and what you can do to help them.
We'll talk a little bit more about your book, but I read it, From Sea to the C-Suite. Fantastic read. You talk about the deck plates in that as well. I would encourage everyone to get a copy of this and read some more detail about going to the deck plates. Cutler, who was the most impactful leader in your life and what quality did you admire about them?
I had numerous while I was in the Navy, but the quality that I enjoyed the most was the leaders that got to know me as an individual. And that they cared about me, and I could tell that they cared about me. And they were not only my leaders, but they were my mentors. And I remember one particular one, Bill Schiffer, when I had my first assignment at the Pentagon. I would go in to see him with my problem of the day, and I knew that he had numerous problems of his own, but he would stop, and he would focus on me, and he would make me feel like I was the most important person in his world. And I tried to do that throughout my career. But really, it's about caring for your people.
Cutler, in reading your book, there was a quote you used that you used to inspire those people that work for you. And it really got my attention. And it was you are the captain of your own ship. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what that means and how it was useful to you and the leaders you were developing.
Absolutely. What I mean by captain of your own ship, when you are the captain of a ship, sometimes you're in the middle of the ocean and you don't have anybody to turn to make decisions. You don't have anybody to turn to ask, what should I do now? You have to be the captain of that ship. And I translated that into, let's say, Navy Federal's organization, where I would tell branch managers that I said, you are the captain of the ships of Navy Federal. You're the ones that are facing the members or customers, as others call them, every day. And you have to make decisions without a lot of guidance in some cases and without a lot of time. So be the captain of your own ship. Step up, make decisions, do what you think is right, and you never can go wrong.
I think that is so important. And you have to give your people a little bit of latitude to take some risk as well, because there is risk for them in doing that and risk to your organization.
That's right. And I mentioned that I took command of my first ship with 5 years in the Navy, and I was 27 years old. Well, my boss had 32 years in the Navy, and his guidance to me when I first met him was, Cutler, you do the right thing, and I'll back you up all the way. What a wonderful way to spend an assignment with backup and guidance like that.
What great advice. It's clear leadership is a topic you're passionate about. You wrote the book we mentioned before, From Sea to C-Suite. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yes. When I was at Navy Federal, I would tell sea stories. As parables to get my point across. And folks would tell me, Cutler, we like your stories. It gives us a picture of what you're trying to tell us. Now, what else are they going to say? They work for me, but I took it as a compliment, and it was. And my wife encouraged me to write a book, and I needed a co-author to help me. And I found a lady named Taylor Keelan, who was the perfect co-author. She turned in my stories into wonderful chapters that I'm very proud of.
Where can listeners find a copy?
Well, you can get it on Amazon, and you can also get it on the Naval Institute website. And I might add that any proceeds from the book, Navy Federal uses to give to charity.
Fantastic. Cutler, thank you very much. Really enjoyed your time and your lessons and in leadership and sharing with us your life story. And I've learned a lot both from talking to you today and reading your book. And thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. And I would like to add one thing, if I could, Shane. During my assignments in Washington, D.C., I gained the utmost respect for the civilians that work here every day. They're hardworking, they're dedicated, and they have my eternal gratitude. I got to come and go from the Pentagon. They stayed every day and worked in Washington when I got to go out and enjoy being at sea.
Perfect, thank you. Yeah, WEPA serves civilian federal employees, but your comment is well taken because the interaction between the two is continuous, it's nonstop, and it's critical. So the career civil servants, as well as career military, our country would not be where it is today without them.
I totally agree. And I can tell you from the U.S. Navy standpoint, we couldn't operate like we do without them being the backbone of what we do.
Thank you very much for your time today, Cutler. And to everyone listening to Lessons in Leadership podcast, we'll see you next time.